Let's get back into the Word at Isaiah chapter number 39. We'll start at verse 1 in just a moment. The parallels that you should be aware of are in 2 Kings chapter 20, starting at verse 12, and 2 Chronicles 32, starting at verse 24, which I'm going to come back to in just a little bit. The situation is this. Hezekiah, still a young man, was told by God through the prophet Isaiah, get your house in order, you're going to die. Now, he had some sort of open wound or tumor, a boil, and immediately he began talking to God about it, grieving over the fact that he had done so much for God. He had been such a good king, and that's true. He is specified in Scripture as the greatest of the Judean kings. And that's from a moral standpoint, not just simply what he did as king. God heard his plea for more time and sent Isaiah back to the room in the palace that he'd just come from to let Hezekiah know he was getting 15 more years. Now, there was a little bit of a sign offered to him. Do you want the shadow to go backward or forward on the shadow clock? And he said, well, it's always moving forward. I want it to go backward. And it did. And so Hezekiah knew now that he had been given more time. Now, that is very happy stuff at the very beginning, but the more you start thinking about it, the more it starts bothering you. That is, I only have 15 more years. He knew when he was going to die. And so he'll be wrestling with that, and we'll come back to that aspect of this part of his story later. Shortly after that, he gets some out-of-country visitors. Here we go. Chapter 39 of Isaiah, verse 1. At that time, Merodach-Baladan, the son of Baladan, king of Babylon, sent envoys with letters and a present to Hezekiah, for he heard that he had been sick and had recovered. Now, we know who this Merodach-Baladan is. He had seized control of Babylon City and the region right around it whenever Shalmaneser died in 722. And he managed to keep it under his control for about a dozen years until, I think it's Sargon, takes it back away from him. And then he'll seize it again right around 704, I think, for a few months before he loses it permanently. And so this guy is a native Babylonian that is fighting against the Assyrian invaders. And so it would appear that he reaches out to a man of kindred spirit. Hezekiah was the only one in the lower Middle East that was able to resist the Assyrians trying to take over his capital city. When Merodach finds out that he had been miraculously healed, because that seems to be part of the story here, he reached out to him as a potential ally against the Assyrians. Now, what happens next becomes important in the bigger picture that we've been looking at through the prophet Isaiah. And that is, Jerusalem is going to be spared from the Assyrians, but not from the coming judgment under the Babylonians. Here we go. Verse number 2. Hezekiah welcomed these Babylonians gladly, and he showed them his treasure house, the silver, the gold, the spices, the precious oil, his whole armory, all that was found in his storehouses. So he shows these delegates from Babylon everything that he has under his control in storage to resist the Assyrians and anyone else that wants to try to take over his country of Judea. He shows the weaponry. He shows the big things that are on the towers, the stone throwers and the rapid shooters that had been made by previous kings to him as well. Shows them everything. There was nothing in his house or in all his realm that Hezekiah did not show them. This was a major security breach. He should never have allowed these guys to know just how much stuff he had, should never allow these guys to know just how capable they were of resisting anyone coming their direction. And so God gets after him about this. Now, before I continue in the Isaiah 39 passage, I want to take a little bit of a detour over into 2 Chronicles 32. Starting at verse 24, the prophet writer of this section of Chronicles says this: "In those days Hezekiah became sick and was at the point of death, and he prayed to the Lord," prayed to He Who Is, "and he answered him and gave him a sign." So that was the shadow on the shadow clock going backward. But now here comes the evaluation, the judgment on what happened next. "But Hezekiah did not make return according to the benefit done to him, for his heart was proud." So he apparently did this show and tell with the Babylonians because he was so proud of his kingdom, so proud of what he had accomplished. He had momentarily forgotten that God was the one that made him strong, made him capable of resisting the Assyrians, gave him his life back. And so we have this report: "Therefore, wrath came upon him and Judah and Jerusalem. But Hezekiah humbled himself for the pride of his heart, both he and the inhabitants of Jerusalem, so that the wrath of He Who Is did not come upon them in the days of Hezekiah." We're going to read that in just a moment. That even though Hezekiah had a moment of hubris and foolishly showed his strength to a future threat to his kingdom, when he gets called on the carpet, he appropriately repents. Now, we'll see that even in his repentance, he's a little bit self-centered, but he is genuinely sorry that he let this information get out to the Babylonians. And God protects the kingdom for another 100 years or so, another 100 plus years in order to wait until the appropriate time for judgment to fall. Okay, a reminder of just how wealthy this guy is. Verse 27, "Hezekiah had very great riches and honor. He made for himself treasuries for silver, for gold, for precious stones, for spices, for shields, for all kinds of costly vessels, storehouses also for the yield of grain, wine, and oil, stalls for every kind of cattle and sheepfolds. He likewise provided cities for himself and flocks and herds in abundance, for God had given him very great possessions." So the stuff that he shows is not just simply at Jerusalem. He apparently shows maybe documents, maybe accounting ledgers of his wealth, the kingdom's wealth, all over the place. This same Hezekiah closed the upper outlet of the waters of Gihon and directed them down to the west side of the city of David. We talked about that. That may be Hezekiah's tunnel. And Hezekiah prospered in all his works. Then we have the Chronicles prophetic writer making this judgment. And so, in the matter of the envoys of the princes of Babylon, who had sent to him to inquire about the sign that had been done in the land, that is, him being miraculously healed on the very verge of death, God left him to himself in order to test him and to know all that was in his heart. So the Chronicles prophet writer says, God let this play out with the Babylonian envoys showing up to see what Hezekiah would do. Now, God already knows what he's going to do and allows him to carry it out, chides him over it, gets the repentance, but it all gets into the record so that it is understood by later Judeans, later prophets, that one of the reasons that the Babylonians targeted Jerusalem and effectively took it down was because their records from this event knew all the ins and outs of the Judean kingdom. Back to Isaiah chapter 39. Verse 3, then Isaiah the prophet came to King Hezekiah. So in other events, Hezekiah has gotten a messenger from Isaiah. But this time, Isaiah is sent specifically to talk to him. What did these men say? From where did they come to you? And Hezekiah said, well, they've come to me from a far country, from Babylon. Now remember, Babylon right at this time is not all that big of an area. It's the city of Babylon and the region around it. It has been under the thumb, under the foot of the Assyrian Empire for a bit. It may be that this is the earlier time that Merodach Baladan had some limited independence, you know, from 722 to 710 BC, or this may be right around the time that he had his 9 months of resurgence, right around 704 into 703 BC. Whichever time period it is, the Babylonians are the underdog that will be squashed by the Assyrians, but eventually they will pop back up again and will take the lead in being God's agent in judgment on the Assyrians. The Babylonians will never forget how horrendous the Assyrians were to them, and they will make it their goal in life to annihilate them as a force. Okay, so they've come to me from a far country, from Babylon. And he said, what have they seen in your house? And Hezekiah answered, they have seen all that's in my house. There's nothing in my storehouses that I didn't show them. So he's like pretty innocent. He's being naive, but he's innocent in his response. He didn't think there was a problem with it. Then Isaiah said to Hezekiah, hear the word of he who is of the hosts, Yahweh Sabaoth, Yahweh of the armies. Behold, the days are coming when all that is in your house and that which your fathers have stored up till this day shall be carried to Babylon. That's the prediction. The Babylonians will be back. Sure, it's going to be over 100 years later, but they will be back and they will take everything. Nothing shall be left, says he who is. And some of your own sons, actually great-great-grandsons, who will come from you, whom you will father, shall be taken away, and they shall be eunuchs in the palace of the king of Babylon. That's a prediction of the Babylonian exile. It will start in 605 BC. That's when the first group of exiled royalty are taken away by Nebuchadnezzar, prince at that time, but soon to become the king of the Babylonian Empire. And then it will reach its climax in 587 BC when the city of Jerusalem will be destroyed, the temple will be destroyed, and the surviving Judeans, most of them, will be taken away up north into the heart of Mesopotamia. And many of them will become, well, they'll become government officials. When Nebuchadnezzar takes over Judea, he basically absorbs it into his empire, and he brings some of the younger set to become his advisors on Judean affairs and to govern Judean affairs. This is the reason why we've got the story of Daniel and Hananiah and Azariah and Mishael, otherwise known as Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. So that's described right here, that that's coming. Now, what was Hezekiah's response? Sadly, it is this, verse 8. Then Hezekiah said to Isaiah, "The word of he who is that you have spoken is good." Now, there's nothing wrong with that. In fact, that's appropriate. God is right. For he thought, "There will be peace and security in my time." Now that is problematic. The parallel over in 2 Kings puts it this way. This is from 2 Kings 20, verse 19. Then Hezekiah said to Isaiah, "The word of he who is that you have spoken is good," for he thought, "Why not, if there will be peace and security in my days?" So effectively, okay, if that's the way it's going to be, fine. But it's a good thing it's not happening in my time. Now, this, unfortunately, is kind of a self-serving attitude that a lot of people take. And that is, my choices are going to result in some bad repercussions, but as long as it doesn't impact on me, that's fine. Somebody else will have to worry about it. We have a phrase for that that we use. We're kicking it down the road. We're kicking the can down the road. We don't have to worry about it. Somebody else can worry about it. That's not good. That's not true love. We need to think how our choices impact on other people. Just a little bit of application of Hezekiah's situation here. At this point, I want us to go into some other prophecies in the book of Isaiah that relate particularly to Babylon and some of the other cities and countries that will be impacted later in history. We don't know exactly when these were spoken or written down by Isaiah, but this seems as good a place as any to talk about them. So go to Isaiah chapter 13. Isaiah chapter 13, verse 1. The oracle, which it's the burden, not meaning it's something heavy, but rather it's something to be transported, something to be delivered. So this is a delivery of information from God to the people of Judah regarding Babylon. The oracle concerning Babylon, which Isaiah the son of Amos saw. On a bare hill, raise a signal, cry aloud to them, wave the hand for them to enter the gates of the nobles. I myself have commanded my consecrated ones. I've summoned my mighty men to execute my anger, my proudly exalting ones. So this prophecy starts out with people being signaled to by God to come this direction. I've got a job for you. Come here. Now, what is that job? It's the destruction of Babylon that's going to happen, under the hands of the Medes and the Persians. Verse 4, the sound of a tumult is on the mountains, as of a great multitude. The sound of an uproar of kingdoms, of nations gathering together. Understand, this is a prophecy about what will happen to Babylon well before Babylon becomes the main empire of the Middle East. They're going to end up with the Medes and the Persians and a whole bunch of other associated groups coming against them to carry out God's judgment. He who is of the hosts is mustering a host for battle. They come from a distant land, from the end of the heavens, he who is, and the weapons of his indignation, to destroy the whole land. Wail, for the day of the Lord is near. As destruction from the Almighty, it will come. This is one of the places that illustrate the use of the term Day of the Lord. It is specifically about God's major judgment upon usually a people group or upon a situation at a particular point in time. The destruction of Babylon is going to be a day of the Lord. But that term will eventually be applied to the ultimate day of the Lord when Jesus is preparing to come back and finish everything up. The final 3.5 years before his arrival in the skies over Jerusalem is referred to as the day of the Lord. It's the ultimate day of the Lord. And all these little mini days of the Lord, M-I-N-I, that precede that one, they have elements and imagery that appear whenever we talk about the big day of the Lord that's yet to come. Verse 7, therefore, all hands will be feeble, every human heart will melt. You know, it's scary when God's judgment is being brought down on a situation. They will be dismayed. Pangs and agony will seize them. They will be in anguish like a woman in labor. So, you know, they're going to not be able to control themselves with all the pain and terror that jumps on them. They will look aghast at one another. Their faces will be aflame. Behold, the day of the Lord comes, cruel with wrath and fierce anger, to make the land a desolation and to destroy its sinners from it. For the stars of the heavens and their constellations will not give their light. The sun will be dark at its rising and the moon will not shed its light. Now we actually see that information tied in to the ultimate day of the Lord. The sun will go dark, the moon will go blood red, the stars will be falling from the sky, and I really believe that the sun will literally go dark, the moon will literally turn blood red, and I do believe there will be a lot of shooting stars. In fact, some of them will be angels falling to planet Earth from their heavenly realm. But the imagery here, many Bible teachers will say, is apocalyptic in the sense of the whole society is going to be turned on its head. Everything's going to fall apart. It's going to be like creation is coming apart at the seams. And that's why people are so panicked. I can see that as being kind of metaphorical, but I want you to remember that the heavens, sun, moon, and stars, are often stand-ins for the heavenly host, that is the angelic realm. And there will be spiritual warfare going on at the time that Babylon falls to the Medes and the Persians. Verse 11, I will punish the world for its evil and the wicked for their iniquity. I will put an end to the pomp of the arrogant and lay low the pompous pride of the ruthless. I will make people more rare than fine gold and mankind than the gold of Ophir. So a lot of people are going to die or be moved, and there won't be many people left. Therefore, I will make the heavens tremble. The earth will be shaken out of its place at the wrath of he who is of the hosts in the day of his fierce anger. And like a hunted gazelle, or like sheep with none to gather them, each will turn to his own people, each will flee to his own land. So there's going to be panic everywhere. Whoever is found will be thrust through. Whoever is caught will fall by the sword. Their infants will be dashed in pieces before their eyes. Their houses will be plundered, their wives ravished. All of that happens during the overrun of Babylon by the Medes and the Persians. And verse 17 makes it very clear that we're talking about the Mede and Persian takeover of Babylon. Behold, I'm stirring up the Medes against them, who have no regard for silver and do not delight in gold.